Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and it's time to do the roundup. The repeal of the state's death penalty passes the legislature with a veto-proof majority. Governor Chris Sununu and the legislature continue their face-off on the next two-year state budget. And the 2020 primary race just got a little bit more crowded. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today. You can watch at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Jeff Feingold, reporter with New Hampshire Business Review, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, and for the first part of the program today, NHPR's Casey McDermott. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Great to be here.
Again, listeners, we'd love to hear your voice as part of this conversation today. Give us a call, the number 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk first about the death penalty repeal legislation that the Senate voted on 17-6 to repeal the death penalty in New Hampshire. The House voted to repeal last month. We'll start with you, Ethan. Could New Hampshire be really on the way to ending the death penalty?
Yeah, so this was sort of the crucial bellwether vote that has been anticipated for a while. The ACLU, looking at this year's Senate, had tallied up at least 16 votes based on senators who had already voted to repeal or who as representatives in the House had voted to repeal or who on the campaign trail had said that they supported repeal of the death penalty. The one kind of wild card senator was Senator David Starr, who took the District 1 seat from Senator Jeff Woodburn, and he ended up being in favor of repeal as well. So it was a 17-6 vote that easily clears the 16-vote threshold to override a veto.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because even one senator was not there. Was Senator Lou D'Alessandro voted, and he was not present, and he's been actively in favor of the death penalty. So even if it shows up for a veto vote, override vote, and he's and the 16 stay the same, it'll still be an overriding of the veto, of the governor's veto.
So what are we hearing? What are Senate Republicans who voted to end this kind of capital punishment saying about the legislation?
Well, I think they really have historically what they've been saying basically is that it's just not the moral factor of this and what it is about this basically. The state-sponsored killing, I guess, really. It's not really anything different from what the arguments of people who oppose the death penalty are saying.
And we've talked about this before. It's really kind of hard to pinpoint any one reason for this sort of shift, but there has been a definite shift in public opinion that has turned against. It's now very much evenly matched, I believe, in polling. About half of America supports the capital punishment, half of it doesn't. And that's kind of played out on an individual level, as I said before, not on a party level, but on a very individual level, people will speak about their own personal experiences a lot.
Something that's interesting is that the last time this came, the death penalty repeal came as close as it is, and it's actually closer than it was. It was in 2000 when both houses passed the repeal of the death penalty, but then Governor Shaheen vetoed it. But there was not enough votes to override her veto. So that's 19 years ago, and this has been a very long process. The attempt to the the effort to override, to repeal the death penalty has been a decades-long process in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting that finally in 2019, it seems they're on the threshold of doing it.
So were you covering this kind of thing, Jeff, back then when Governor Shaheen vetoed it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was very controversial among Democrats. They were very upset about it, actually, because they came so close to repealing it, because it's been a major It's been part of the Democratic Party's effort. It's been there part of their platform to get rid of this.
And do you happen to remember if at the time there was anybody on New Hampshire's death row?
No, as far as I know, there was no one.
Yeah, there was no one there.
There was no one on there because there hasn't been anyone on death
row.
Right. You know,
but Michael Addison has been there since 2006, right?
Yeah, it's been there. Yeah.
And so, and his wife of the man Michael Addison killed, yes. Laura Briggs, who was married to Michael Briggs, the police officer, she's been speaking against the repeal of the death penalty. Has she moved any hearts and minds at all with her testimony?
I think her biggest impact is in Manchester, mm-hmm. where if you notice that Senator Kavanaugh voted against the repeal, and Senator Dallas Angel we've talked about, and I have to say that part of the bill Michael Addison would still be executed under this bill. Mm-hmm. It would not cover him. Which is interesting.
Well, it's something that's definitely up for debate. It was certainly a part of yesterday's debate, whether or not that's true. There are, differing outcomes in states that have repealed their death penalties. Some of them have allowed their death row inmates, the executions, to move forward. And in some cases, the courts have basically de facto commuted those cases. Yeah. Even if the conviction was and the punishment was set before the penalty was repealed. So that was a big feature. I think one thing that the Laura Briggs testimony did is it kind of galvanized the opposition to repeal in a very emotional way. Senator Sharon Carson of Londonderry spoke emotionally on how this was effectively taking away this punishment that had already been adjudicated and would hurt the Briggs family. It's certainly something that we'll have to just see happens, whether there's repeal or not, in terms of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that this law, if it was to stand, that it would help the Addison appeal, because they would have another avenue to appeal his penalty.
Mm-hmm. So the governor has said in the past that he would veto it. Has he said anything since the Senate vote?
As far as I know, he reiterated the same statement. He didn't comment on kind of any changing reality. He just said that he would stand for crime victims and law enforcement, and that's been a consistent statement that he's said. I should just point out nothing is a done deal. Votes could change. Things could change by veto day in September. Mm-hmm. It's unclear. The other thing is that the House is notoriously hard to pin down. They do have an over two-thirds, well over two-thirds.
How comfortable is that, though?
I think it's 76% the last vote. So that's over 66%. But that was with, I think, the high 370s in that particular voting session showed up. Hmm. And as we know, turnout fluctuates
a lot.
Doesn't
always happen that way.
If the turnout dropped into 350, 340, 330 on veto override day, that could potentially change the outcome. So it's just in this legislature of all legislatures, it's really hard to ever counter chicken.
In the Senate, it was a factor of two senators, right? If two senators flip to the other side, then the two-thirds majority is gone, right?
Right.
According to the union leader.
They're at 17, and if they fall below 16, then they do not have enough to override.
Yeah. So this could sort of play itself out within this month.
Yeah, and as Ethan said, it is a matter of who shows up on the vote, the day of the vote. It's not a done deal, but it's as close as they've ever gotten.
Yeah, it wouldn't play out this month. Right now, the bill is moving to the governor's desk that goes through an enrollment process that can take. It depends on kind of which cogs in the wheel move faster, but it could happen next week. He could veto this bill, but we won't know until September when the House and Senate reconvene to vote on an extremely long session this year expected for veto override.
Yeah, it feels long at least.
Yeah.
Listeners, we're rounding up the week's news, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on it. The number is 1-800-892-6477. In just a little bit, we'll speak with NHPR's Casey McDermott about lawmakers and potential conflicts of interest. Lawmakers in New Hampshire, of course, don't get paid very much, so they have outside businesses, and sometimes legislation aligns or conflicts with that those interests. And we want to know if you've read Casey's story, if you have further questions about it, now's the time to ask her. Give us a call now. We'll bring you into the conversation. 1-800-892-6477. But before we get to Casey, let's talk about the budget a little bit. That was big news this week as well. The House passed the $12.9 billion budget, basically passed on party lines. Jeff, I wanted to ask you about this, if I could. What are some key ways do you think this differs from the governor's budget?
You have enough time to talk about that?
Can you give us
the cliff
notes?
I don't have an hour. Pretty much in every way. You know, the governor's key insertion into the budget was this forensic psychiatric unit, and it's he made a big deal of it. He gave some speeches on it, and apparently what the Democrats did was first to remove it completely. Now there's about $1 million in there to design it and to build it sometime in the future. Paid family medical leave was his plan was to have a voluntary program with Vermont, and the Democrats removed that and put in their own plan, which is something that the governor opposes because it has a payroll deduction. You could go down the list. The business tax, basically freezing the business tax cuts to last year's level, getting rid of this year's cut and other future cuts. That's a big thing. And maybe the biggest one is the institution of a capital gains tax, which New Hampshire doesn't have. That would be, That's a new tax in New Hampshire. There's more deductions and there's more limits on people. So the threshold to pay it is much higher, and of course there's a raft of aid to cities and towns, from school aid to revenue sharing, which has not been in the budget for a long time. And that's pretty much covers the basic ones.
The big differences, yeah. Ethan, what do you think?
Well, so one thing interesting about New Hampshire is that we have a law that requires there to be a balanced budget, and so everybody's working with the same pot. It's just everyone's carving it up differently. It's not like some budgets are much bigger than others.
Well, the Democrats' budget was $300 million bigger, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, and there's some I can't really speak to that. I haven't looked at the numbers exactly. There is some accounting differences in how certain things were tallied up. So I can't speak to that. But in general, you can't really go too far out the lines. The other thing that's interesting this year is that we are pretty flush with revenue for the second year in a row. We have the last count from the Department of Administrative Services is we have about $147 million more than we had planned for in the 2017 budget. And then the third major factor is obviously the legislature has changed hands, but you still have a strong Republican governor in the office, the corner office. So those factors kind of open up there to be these wide philosophical differences. You've got a lot of money. You've got lines over how much you can spend, but you've got a lot of money to spend. And the question is what to do. And philosophically, they're very different. So the governor has and Republicans have championed using the surplus money, which is not expected to stay around for a while. A lot of this had to do with repatriation, which came in after the Washington tax cuts under President Trump. And that's not going to continue forever. And so Republicans argue this is one-time money that should be used for one-off expenses. Democrats say we're in economically good times. There are a lot of social services that we've underfunded, and there are towns and cities that are suffering from high property tax burdens. Yep. We should send that money back. Republicans say if you start paying for making long-term investments with money that might not return, you're putting the state on the hook in the future where we might not be able to pay for it again.
The interesting thing is really that some of the things that the Democrats were doing was just basically reinstituting things that the legislature did pay for in the past, like revenue sharing, mm-hmm. and also the education inadequacy payments, have been stagnant. They're just saying, well, look, because of the state government's intransigence or inability to recognize the needs of the cities and towns, the state needs to pony up again. So it's as Ethan said, it's a big philosophical difference because there's very little room for a middle ground with both sides the way they're standing where they are. But it remains to be seen what the Senate will do.
And there's talk already, which is not great this early on, but there's talk already of a continuing resolution.
A continuing resolution.
There has been
April.
A little bit of talk in June, and that would happen if they couldn't pass a budget that the governor could sign by June 30th.
Yeah, we went through this under Governor Hassan. If you remember, mm-hmm. For those with longer memories,
potentially could be a long summer. summer, or a short one.
A short one. Okay. So the governor's already called on the Senate Finance Committee to quote, fix this mess.
Yes.
So what role is Governor Sununu going to play here? Is he going to start putting pressure on the Senate?
I assume he's going to start trying to put pressure on the Senate. I don't know. He's been out there talking to different groups, a lot of business groups and others, about the budget and complaining about it. But I'm not quite sure how much he's reached out to the people who are writing the budgets in the legislature. And it's, you know, that's part of his strategy.
If you talk to Democrats in the Senate, for instance, Majority Leader Dan Feltes, he says that there hasn't been any communication from the governor. We'll see how that plays out. The Senate is kind of, you know, everything moves there, and they're seen as sort of the backstop often politically on the House budgets. And they sort of pride themselves as somewhere where there can be more negotiations. So we'll see. But there are some major kind of deal breakers for the governor. And for Democrats in both versions.
Another way to look at this budget coming out of the House is that it's really like a template for 2020 from the House budget and also the governor's budget. And that's what they're going to be running on in a lot of ways. And I think that's really what they're making. They're making political statements right now. That's why the Senate might have a more difficult road to hoe, because are they willing to do that as well? But, I mean, I really think that they're putting the governor on notice that, you know, we're serious about paid family medical leave. We're serious about aid to cities and towns and property taxes. And I think that's going to be the what the campaign is going to be about, at least from the Democrats' point of view in 2020. But we have to see if the governor's going to be running for governor again in 2020. You know, there's been questions about other things.
Still don't quite know about that. Okay. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's turn now to NHPR's Casey McDermott. She's been doing some investigating into conflicts of interest lawmakers run into from time to time at the State House. So, Casey, what types of jobs do lawmakers hold, and sort of where does the potential for conflicts of interest usually come up?
So I should preface this by reminding people that we have a citizen legislature. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of baked into the premise of New Hampshire's government that people are going to bring certain outside experiences, whether that's personal experiences or professional ones, with them into the State House. So that manifests itself in a whole lot of different ways. We have a number of state retirees who are serving in the State House who then have to vote on, or in some cases choose to sponsor, legislation that could affect the benefits for the state retirement system. We have business owners who routinely vote on or sponsor issues related to small businesses, and that's everything from hiring practices to business taxes to any number of other things. There's also a fair number of people who are serving in the legislature who, for example, are real estate agents or landlords or own property and derive income from that, because, frankly, that's one of the jobs that's flexible enough to allow someone to put in the amount of time in the legislature and not have to, you know, work a kind of 9-to-5 because they can derive income from that, you know, that profession. So that's all to say that there are a lot of different experiences that people bring with them into their jobs at the State House. And I was curious, just having reported on New Hampshire state government for the last few years, about how people draw the line between those personal experiences and the actual policy making that they're responsible for.
Mm-hmm. So what answer did you come up with? How do people draw that line?
It depends. So the ethics rules are fairly permissive. Again, like I said, they operate from the premise that people are bound to have these kinds of conflicts of interest that they run into. And the approach that New Hampshire's ethics rules take favors disclosure over recusal. So in other words, it really relies on lawmakers to take it upon themselves to be transparent about the potential conflicts that they bring with them to their work. And, you know, in most cases, if they disclose, they are still allowed to vote on certain pieces of legislation. Now, if there was a specific bill that was designed to specifically benefit lawmaker, you know, Joe Smith's, I just made that up. That's not a real lawmaker.
Right.
You know, lawmaker Joe Smith's business, then that would be another issue. But if it's something where, you know, let's say lawmaker Joe Smith is, for example, a landlord, and he wants to sponsor a bill that would affect all types of security deposits. He would be allowed to do that, even though it would affect the industry that he works in, as long as it's not a specific carve out for his business that generally is allowed under the state's rules.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the nature of the disclosure, because in some cases it's written.
Yes.
And in some cases it's just they say it right before they debate whatever point they're trying to make.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, and this is something that the public should be more aware of, because it's the information is actually somewhat buried on the state's website. And part of what we wanted to do is make this information more accessible to people. So basically, at the beginning of every legislative session, lawmakers are supposed to fill out a form that discloses where they got, $10,000 or more of their income and the different sources that either they or their household members earned income from in the last year. Now, that is left open to interpretation about what you count as income. Some people list various sources of property. Many people don't. Some lawmakers list investment income. That's actually not required, so many people leave that out. And in general, those forms are not audited after they are turned in. So there is a lot of variety in the level of information that is actually provided. Many of the disclosures are not very detailed in terms of actually informing people about, okay, what is the nature of this lawmaker's relationship to the business that they listed there? So that really means that this tool that is meant to inform people about the potential conflicts that their lawmakers are bringing with them into office is really falling short in many cases because the information is often not there.
Mm-hmm. And you reported on a couple of examples of lawmakers who they're not necessarily trying to hide what they're doing. I mean, for example, Senate President Donna Soucy, Democrat, she's done legal work for the firefighters.
She's a staff attorney for the professional firefighters of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. So she lists that on her financial disclosure form. And that's a very influential labor union around the state house. And they get involved on a number of different bills, both related to, emergency response, but also issues of organized labor, workers' compensation, things like that. So she's disclosed that on her financial disclosure forms, but she's not recused herself from votes that have affected that union. So I think that illustrates, one way that lawmakers handle those issues. There's also, for example, getting back to the business owner perspective that we mentioned before, former Senate President, Senator Soucy's colleague, Chuck Morse, owns a nursery business. And so plants, things like that. Does not recuse himself from votes dealing with wages, hiring practices, and actually invokes his experience often on the Senate floor in debates about those issues. Because from his perspective, I talked to him about this. He said, look, people want business people to come up to Concord. And the way he sees it is he's bringing his professional experience into it. He said there are certain circumstances where he has recused himself from votes in the past. But it's largely left up to individual lawmakers to make that determination.
So when we say conflict of interest, I mean, that often carries a kind of negative connotation. But in some ways, what you're describing is that lawmakers are almost using their personal lives and perhaps their livelihoods and their position as a lawmaker as just an extension of their advocacy. Like business owners will advocate for business owners. And if a public school teacher becomes a lawmaker, they may advocate for public school teachers.
I think that's how many inside the state house would characterize it. I think, where it gets a little tricky is where, you start to ask the question of, okay, who are you really working for here? If it comes down to it and there's a conflict between, your role as an attorney or your role, for example, another instance that I highlight in the story is House Majority Leader Doug Lay, who is one of the most powerful Democrats in the House right now, also happens to be the president of the American Federation of Teachers of New Hampshire, which, again, is a wide-reaching and powerful education union in the state. And in his capacity as union president, has testified multiple times in support of bills that or against bills that the union has taken a position on. I think when you're the leader of an organization, when you're an attorney for an organization, even when you're the head of a small business, there are legitimate questions that I think the public can raise about, are you representing, even if you say you're bringing your outside experience and your outside roles, are you representing that specific organization, or are you representing your constituents and everyone in your district? Mm-hmm.
So if a listener is wondering about whether or not their particular representatives have a conflict of interest that they've disclosed, where can they go to find out?
They can head over to nhpr.org. As I said, we tried to kind of liberate these financial disclosure forms from their paper forms, where you can usually find them, and make them more accessible to people. So it's nhpr.org. We put those into a search database, but we also included links to every lawmaker's original form. So if you want to actually take a look at the files that people actually filled out, many cases handwritten, so that can make it a little bit difficult to decipher. But we tried to make that information more accessible to people so that they can, you know, fulfill the role as it's envisioned in the state's ethics rules and be, you know, be the ones to ask questions and hold their lawmakers accountable about this.
Well, Casey, thank you very much for shedding some sunlight on this. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
That's NHPR's Casey McDermott. You can find a link to her story at nhpr.org. We're speaking about the week's news here with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. And still to come on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, an Epping High School student came to school wearing a President Trump Make America Great Again t-shirt. Her principal asked her to change or cover up her shirt, which begs the question, were her First Amendment rights to free speech violated? The ACLU has now gotten involved, but what do you think? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video of this radio program. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I listen to NHPR because it opens up my world.
Peg Hendel of Waterville Valley is a proud member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
I really value the fair and well-researched and well-balanced information that I get. That's something I just had to support.
You too can join NHPR's growing family of Leadership Circle members when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust at nhpr.org/leaders.
On Monday on The Exchange, we'll be talking about Under the Starry Flag, about the impact of Irish-American involvement in the Fenian Revolution, a 19th-century effort to free Ireland from British rule. That's coming up on Monday on The Exchange. But right now, we are taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me are Jeff Feingold, reporter with New Hampshire Business Review, and Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. NHPR's Lauren Chulgin is going to join us in just a little bit for a conversation about Pam Smart. But right now, we're going to talk about a story reported on for a few news outlets this week, including the Union Leader, which reported that the school superintendent of Epping High School, Valerie McKinney, says she's investigating an incident where during America Day at the school, a day when students wear red, white, and blue, a freshman, Soretta McKenzie, wore a President Trump t-shirt. She was asked by the principal to change her shirt or cover it up. So Jeff, what did she end up doing?
Well, she ended up going to the press. What else do? You go to the Union Leader. And it was, it's one of these issues where I think, you know, we're so polarized now that something like this really does get some legs and it gets big on social media. And, she makes a very good argument. But from what I understand about the First Amendment, you don't necessarily have it. You don't necessarily have complete First Amendment rights in a school. And there are people who get sent to go out of school if their skirts are too short or if they're wearing, another kind of T-shirt. And it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that to that point, so you mentioned earlier that the ACLU got involved. They did release a statement. They didn't suggest anything about legal action, which might perhaps go to your point, Jeff. But they did say that they, opposed the action, that they supported the students' free speech rights, and that they would be filing a records request with the school to find out what their First Amendment policies are, which, I think the last time this happened that kind of got national attention, or the last time I could find, was in 2017. There was a Georgia high school teacher who requested that two students turn their Make America Great shirts inside out. She justified that. She said, I had, allowed Trump shirts in before, but this was 2 weeks after the Charlottesville riots, and, people were very kind of emotionally charged at that point, and she ended up, there ended up being a big backlash to that. I don't think there was any legal action, but that teacher did resign. And so, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. The school, as I understand it, the superintendent of the school is conducting an investigation, but has been very tight-lipped on what that investigation would entail, and released a statement saying that we'll make sure to that this incident doesn't ever happen again. But again, it's unsure what that means.
Yeah, it does. It's not clear about what the student's reaction was to the T-shirt. It was mostly, it seems like it was an adult reaction to the T-shirt, from what I understand.
From how the union leader described it, it seemed like, at least from their publicly made statements, that they were concerned about the student's safety, that there were, that this might have been so provocative that she may have been the target of some kind of harassment. So from an interview with WMUR, the high school student, Soretta McKenzie, spoke about how she wished the situation were handled.
I don't understand why I was dress coded. There's no reason. Mm-hmm. I was supporting my president. What is wrong with that? I wish he just told me, hey, you are wearing a Trump shirt. He is controversial. But I'm not going to tell you to cover it up because that is your beliefs. But if you do have any harassment or anything, just come to me and I'll handle it. I wish that was just how we handled it. I think you took the easy way out.
Yeah, it shows that, some people, in educators often respond to things more emotionally than they should in certain cases. And the way she says it is pretty reasonable. And it is what they call a teachable moment for her and for the other students, that they might have had a discussion about it. It's not, but as I said before, it is in the authority of school officials to limit what we would normally say is a free speech issue. If you think how many times a school newspaper is prevented from running a story because the principal doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. It's offensive to people who believe in the freedom of the press, but they are well within their rights to be able to do that in a school building. And that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. The ACLU describes the issue this way. If you're a public school student, you don't check your constitutional rights at the schoolhouse doors. But whether schools can punish you for speaking out depends on when, where, and how you decide to express yourself. Also, you have the right to wear clothing expressing your opinions if it doesn't disrupt school. So who gets to decide
That's
whether or
exactly
not it's,
right.
it's disrupting school, and what are the standards for that? I imagine that the ACLU would really want to know a written policy on what the school has decided.
Yeah, I think that's what they're looking for, and I think a lot of schools don't even have these kind of policies because I think this is relatively new now. I mean, this is the last time I can remember these kind of things happening was in the 60s and 70s when it was a very similar politically fired up moment.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or comment about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. I want to turn our attention to Manchester for a moment because Joyce Craig, she announced that she will be running for re-election. Now she's got a challenger. So, Ethan, what do you think? Who's this challenger?
So the challenger is Victoria Sullivan, formerly of the House, New Hampshire House. And she's sort of a stalwart conservative. She is a pro Second Amendment supporter in the House. She kind of had a long history of supporting social issues in the House. She was the assistant. She was assistant House Majority Leader. Just wanted to get that right. And so she has this sort of long background of being pretty far politically right on the spectrum. But she also has done some. She's done some initiatives in the middle. She had last year, for instance, she sponsored two bipartisan pushes. One was to ban female genital mutilation in New Hampshire, and the other one was to reinstitute play-based education in kindergarten, and those both kind of had strong bipartisan consensus. So she has a different kind of record across the board, and she's running on the idea that there is a conservative case for running Manchester within its tax cap, and that there's a conservative case for running a female conservative against Mayor Joyce Craig, who was the first female mayor.
Mm-hmm. So where, with respect to Manchester politics, would Joyce Craig sort of be vulnerable in the next election?
Yeah, I could say one of the key issues in New Hampshire, in Manchester, is homelessness. And it's very public. There's been a rise in homelessness, a rise in people who are basically camping out on the streets on Elm Street. Restaurant owners and other business owners along Elm Street have been very vocal in their concern about this. Mayor Craig's been trying to work on this. It's not been completely successful at this point. There have been efforts to do it. Others are the, I guess, I wouldn't say it was a rise in crime, but the, you know, they're Manchester's the biggest city in the state, and there's crime, and there's, you know, you hear police sirens frequently. I think that that's really what it's going to be. What will be her weak points, if that's what they are, in her race. But I do have to say that on another level, Manchester has been attracting businesses at a really strong clip. Tech businesses with really big jobs. I mean, just one of the big ones was that they just BAE Systems is building a new facility over in Manchester with supposedly up to 1,000 jobs coming. So the argument on the economy is, you know, things are going really well that way, and it's attracting new people into the city, and actually a lot of young people are moving into the city. So it is a different. There are two different cities there, and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see which ones the voters of Manchester think is the vision that they have.
Mm-hmm. And just also on a strategic note, in terms of potential disadvantages for Victoria Sullivan, she's facing a pretty well-oiled fundraising machine out of Joyce Craig's camp. They released numbers recently that came out with $140,000 in the first quarter of 2019. Those are large numbers. They would be sort of semi-impressive numbers for a gubernatorial run, let alone a mayoral run. So that's a pretty difficult situation to start out in, and so it'll remain to be seen whether Victoria Sullivan can capitalize on sort of latent support for Ted Gatzis,
who lost to Joyce Craig in the last election. So yeah. It's interesting to see it, and with this new blood coming into Manchester, what does the electorate look like when they have the vote in November?
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or comment about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. Reaching back just a moment ago to our conversation about the student wearing the Trump T-shirt in school and being asked to cover it up or change clothing, Walter from Londonderry contends that if a student had worn a Feel the Burn T-shirt, he doubts anyone would have said anything or told her to cover it up. Walter continues, it is another example of the liberal bias of our educators and their willingness to deny free speech to people if they don't agree with that speech. That's the comment from Walter in Londonderry. And let's bring in Eric from Concord really quickly. Eric, thank you very much for your call. What's your question or comment? Oh, we've lost Eric. Thank you very much for your comment, though, Walter. We really appreciate it. Want to move on before the break to a story that the NHPR's Lauren Chulgin has been covering this week, and that's the story of Pamela Smart, one of New Hampshire's most notorious murder trials. Back in the headlines this week, Pamela Smart, now 51, she's asking for a chance to be paroled. She was convicted in her role for the murder of her husband, Greg Smart, in their Derry home almost 3 decades ago. And Lauren, she's asking, not for the first time, for her life sentence to be commuted.
Not for the first time. And so basically she's exhausted all other legal avenues at this point. The only thing that she has left is to ask the governor and the executive council to commute her sentence. And what she's looking for and what she's asked for from past governors is to take away the without the possibility of parole. She is currently in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in New York, serving her life sentence, again, without the possibility of parole. And so she's looking for just a chance at parole. So for those who don't remember Pam Smart, and I know for a lot of people when they hear that, they think, how can people not remember Pam Smart? Because it was such a big deal when it happened. And she's become an almost, I don't even know how to describe it, like a media phenomenon at this point. But Pam Smart was convicted of being an accomplice to the murder of her husband, Greg. She was in her early 20s when this was all happening. Greg was 24 when he was murdered. He was shot and killed by William Flynn, and there were three other teenagers involved in his murder. William Flynn and Pam Smart were having an affair. He was 15 at the time. She was working at Winneconne High School as a media coordinator, and there was a lot of discrepancy that she was a teacher. She was not a teacher, but he was a student at the school, and he basically testified, confessed to the killing, but said that Pam had told me to do it and said it was the only way we could be together, and that if she said that if he didn't kill Greg, there was no other. She didn't want to get divorced because she would lose everything. Now, Pam has disputed that since, you know, the minute the trial began, and has long maintained innocence, though, you know, we had a really interesting conversation. I visited her 2 weeks ago today in prison for another project I've been working on. And we talked a lot about both what she's asking for from the governor's office and also kind of how she thinks about all of this. So first, let's listen to kind of her argument for why she thinks that she should be given the opportunity of parole.
We're a country that says we're merciful, compassionate, we believe in redemption, we believe in rehabilitation, but there's no alternative for someone who has proven that, you know, to be worthy of that. So I just feel like there's a lot I could contribute outside of here. And for anybody who thinks I haven't suffered, I literally have spent my 20s, my 30s, and my 40s, and now going in my 50s in prison. Like, what? You know, I don't know how much more suffering will ever be enough for people.
And so that was, again, I visited Pam Smart in prison 2 weeks ago to interview her. And that's basically the argument that's presented in this like 700-page petition that her attorney is giving the Attorney General, which will then go to the governor. And then the governor will decide when the executive council takes it up. In the petition is, I mean, a lot. There's a letter.
It's like 700 pages.
It is,
right?
Is many pages, yes. And there are letters of support from people you'd expect, like her family, friends that she's made, other inmates in prison. There are also letters from, you know, pretty notable feminists like Gloria Steinem, Kate Millett, who has since passed away. But her case has caught the attention. I mean, it's been catching attention since it began, but it's kind of evolved as, you know, it's been 30 years since this happened. And so the opinions on this case have kept to being passionate, but there has been some evolution on how younger generations are starting to view the fact that she's still in prison and Billy Flynn and the other three, have been let out.
Jeff?
Yeah, I covered several days of that trial back in the early 90s, 91, and I have to say it was a media circus that I had never seen before. This, you know, was the days before the OJ trial, but it wasn't that much, not too much away from that. It was crazy, and there were so many press from around the world covering this that they had to have a closed, they couldn't fit in the courtroom. They had to have a second room with a closed circuit television to watch the trial. That's how the press was covering, some of the press was covering it. This was extremely notorious. You have to remember the other thing is about the boys who were involved in the murder itself.
Mm-hmm.
They're all minors,
mm-hmm.
and that wasn't something else that came into play with her notoriety. That this was, you know, a woman who was manipulating these young people to mm-hmm. do what she wanted, and that's what the jury found in all cases. And they have since been released. She has been fighting for years, maintaining her innocence. You know, at the trial, it becomes pretty clear. It came clear to me that she was involved in this. But, you know, that's what the jury found. So that's the way it was. But the thing is that she's been trying this for years, trying to win sympathy. And it's interesting to watch. Little by little, she becomes a more sympathetic figure because of the distance of time.
Hmm.
You know, when you get Gloria Steinem and Kate Millett supporting you, you know, that shows that there's people who are listening to what she's saying.
Well, Lauren, have you read the letters from Gloria Steinem? I'd be curious to know what kind of argument she's making.
Well, I mean, a lot of what has been discussed in the last few decades or last decade or so is that there was so much attention paid to the fact that she was a woman that, you know, the many feminists, both of them kind of note to this in their letters that, you know, had she been a man, the way she was talked about in the media would have been different. That's their argument. Mm-hmm. And Pam talks about this, too, that, you know, there wouldn't have been as much attention on what I was wearing. And there wouldn't have been all this attention about how I was pretty and all this and how that fed into this, you know, argument of her being this like older manipulative woman that takes, you know, this younger person and tells him what to do because she had, you know, manipulated him in that way. But, you know, what's interesting, and to Jeff's point, that like over the course of time, people see it differently. But also over the course of time, you know, she's gotten older and she's at the outset, she told me, she basically felt like, you know, because I didn't pull the trigger, this wasn't my fault. And that was basically how she felt immediately, in part because she told me, you know, how can you live with the guilt of knowing that you were responsible for your husband's death? But after many years of therapy, after a writing group that she worked on for a long time, after a group therapy session, after, you know, and getting older and becoming more mature, she has really come to a place where she understands that by having an affair with Bill Flynn, she is responsible for Greg's death.
it's interesting that people say, like, oh, you know, she has no remorse or whatever. I cannot have remorse for a crime that I didn't commit, but I do have remorse for the bad choices that I made and the horrible decisions that contributed and led to this. And like I said, I know that even though I didn't pull the trigger now, I'm responsible for his death.
So she's taking some level of responsibility. Lauren, you've been looking at the details here. What do you think are the chances that her sentence
will be commuted? Well, it's so early. I mean, it's so early in the process. I mean, I think, you know, the executive counselors haven't even seen this petition. And like we've said, it's many, many, many pages. But so it's really hard to know. I think the open question is to what Jeff and I have both been saying, that there's so much other stuff with this case. There's the notoriety. There's this like conversation about the media's influence. But, you know, the AG's office has been pretty unequivocal that they do not believe that she should ever be let out of prison. I mean, that hasn't changed. But, you know, I would be curious to see how the process plays out. I, you know, got the statement from the governor that everybody else did, which was basically like he wants to see the process play out like it's any other petition. The executive counselors that we talked to had a very similar thing. You know, it's so early. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen.
Well, we appreciate your reporting. NHPR's Lauren Julgen, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to stick with Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. After a quick break, we'll talk about 2020 primary candidates and their visits to New Hampshire, the waves they're making nationally. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. If you have something you really wanted to hear from the candidates running for president, let us know what that thing is. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. You can also watch a live video of this radio show. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Jeff Feingold, editor with New Hampshire Business Review, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, and making his debut on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we've got Hunter Woodall, AP political reporter. Hey, Hunter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, listeners, we're going to talk about 2020 stuff for the next few minutes or so. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to start with Hunter. You are new to New Hampshire, and so I wanted to know, how are you finding it? How's this retail style of politics looking to you as we run up to the 2020 primary?
Well, I'm absolutely loving it. It was funny. I came out here. I moved 2 days after Valentine's Day in Manchester, and I went to a Marianne Williamson political event in Exeter, and you know they were doing the questions, and a questioner stands up and asks her question, and Williamson didn't really answer, and she goes. The woman asking the question goes, oh, yeah, no, you didn't answer my question. You need to answer. So as a journalist, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll see more of that, I'm sure, if you keep going to these events. Okay. So let me ask you first about this this new poll from the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. It shows former Vice President Joe Biden in the lead. Then there's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. But I think the big news out of this New Hampshire Institute of Politics poll is that Pete Buttigieg surged to third place. So I wanted to ask you your thoughts on that, Hunter.
Well, I do kind of I agree a little bit with New Hampshire Democrats chair Ray Buckley. You know, it's so early. You know, these polls have to be name recognition and stuff like that. But you know, it is clear that the mayor is surging. You know, he had events this weekend. He was very popular, and I mean, huge turnouts both in Manchester and in Concord.
You just add to the name recognition. I know this is like a common talking point that everything's about name recognition, but I saw just a printout of a question that a typical voter gets on the phone over, you know, if this primary were held today, who would you vote for? And the number of names that are in that question is just so long that it kind of underscores that it has to be at this early on to be to some extent about name recognition. If with that many names kind of flying by you, if you haven't had the chance yet, which I think a lot of New Hampshire voters haven't, to see these candidates in person, it's hard to know whether these kind of, you know, again, well-known figures like Biden and Sanders are riding the benefit.
But it is unusual that someone like the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, would be the number three in the poll right now. I mean, I know it's the name recognition works for him because it's
almost impossible to pronounce, but it is, it really is, it is significant that he has been, he somehow has been able to get out of the pack when others have not been.
Well, Hunter, did you end up seeing Pete Buttigieg when he was here in New Hampshire last week?
I did. And my disclaimer and all this stuff is I'm a huge political nerd, so if there's a political event, I'm probably at it or running across the state to get to it.
Okay.
So I went to both of his events, and I mean, they were large crowds, especially the one in Manchester. I think there were maybe about 200 people waiting outside who couldn't get in, which, I mean, those are the crowds you were seeing for Beto O'Rourke when he was here type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that was fascinating. What was odd, though, in a way, was the mayor's approach. You know, he talked for about 15, 20 minutes, didn't take questions from the crowd, and then went straight to the photo line. You know, some people love that because they like, you know, they'd rather have a photo with him and talk to him that way. I know others, you know, kind of felt left out in the cold. You have somebody who drove an hour there, and then, you know, all they hear is 15 minutes. They don't get to ask their question. That can upset some folks.
So hopefully he'll be back to answer some questions. We've got some news on the debate status because Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, she reached the threshold to participate in the first two Democratic primary debates. Candidates needed 65,000 individual donations to meet the threshold. Hunter, your thoughts on Gabbard's candidacy?
Well, it's been interesting. I talked to a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters here in the state, and you know, I often hear they love Bernie, they're sticking with Bernie, but they also love Gabbard. So mm-hmm. there is clear that she's kind of tied in with Sanders, given her support for the senator back in 2016. You know, there are people who really like her, but you know, she's not somebody I hear in somebody's like top five right now. But again, it is so early.
Mm-hmm. And Sanders, of course, made his pitch this week for the Medicare for All proposal. That's very popular among some Democrats. New Hampshire's congressional delegation sort of putting some daylight between themselves and Medicare for All. Even Senator Shaheen, who at one point had co-sponsored legislation mm-hmm. for Medicare for All, but now kind of walking that back. Have you had any insight on that, Hunter?
Well, with any of these proposals, I think what's been fascinating is it's going to be so hard to pass some of them no matter what. I mean, when you look at it, even if you have a Dem-controlled Congress and you're winning both the House, you know, keeping the House, winning the Senate and the presidency, you're probably going to have to get rid of the filibuster to get some of this stuff through. I mean, it's incredibly hard. So I'm wondering if people are starting to get a little bit more realistic just about these challenges because, again, you have to demolish the filibuster probably. You know, you can't really pass stuff through reconciliation. It really will be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. So just to speak to Shaheen's position. So in 2017, she was one of the first adopters of the Medicare for All bill. She was one of 16. There are four presidential candidates who are also senators who supported it then and still support it now. She's not supporting it in 2019, or she's not sponsoring it. She might vote for it, but
we don't know yet.
We don't know if she's going to vote for it. Her spokesman didn't specify, but she is also facing a very fierce re-election effort next year in which she has to court all the state's voters, not just the primary population.
So different electorate.
Right.
Yeah, I think she's a very shrewd politician, very smart about this stuff, and I think she's doing the calculus and realizes that she's got to find a little bit more middle, go move a little bit more to the middle on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a sense from an academic I talked to that you know, it's just a totally different ballgame when you look at a Senate race, even a federal Senate race, and a presidential primary, because there's a sense that it's worth taking the risk for some of these candidates. They see it's worth taking the risk on Medicare for All now because it's part of a whole raft of issues in their platform, and because the election will likely ultimately fall on people's opinion of the president when it comes down to who becomes the nominee. So they're more willing to take a chance than Shaheen, who's well known to the state and would be kind of sticking her neck out, given that none of the other members of the federal delegation are supporting it. And it's notable to just add that in 2017, when Shaheen supported Medicare for All, her statement supporting it said, while this is a Republican-controlled Congress and this bill has no chance of getting anywhere, I think it sends an important message. Mm. Now it's, you know, a little bit less of a Republican-controlled Congress, and she is not putting a name on it. So it may have been a symbolic support from the beginning based on her own words.
Mm-hmm. Well, really quickly, I want to ask you, Hunter, about Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell of California jumping into the race for president. Seems like his platform so far is based on banning military-style assault rifles.
And it's kind of fascinating. With such a large field, I think you are going to start seeing these candidates really adopt one issue and really just hammer it home. I mean, it's like Washington Governor Jay Inslee on climate change. Like, you know, he is very clearly running on that, and he talks about other topics, but that's his big thing. I think it's a really interesting tactic from the congressman. Will it connect? You know, it isn't really clear. I mean, obviously, it's a very politicized issue right now, and it is a hyper-partisan time in America.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we should leave the primary stuff there for a moment, but I did want to ask— about, of course, we have to do the animal story. This is the roundup. So maybe I'll turn to you on this, Jeff, because apparently the family of Ted Gatzis, they have a horse, and that horse did pretty well enough to qualify for the Kentucky Derby.
Vekoma, the leader past the 16th pole. It is Vekoma.
So Vekoma winning the Bluegrass Stakes. His owner's going to have a horse in the Kentucky Derby for the very first time.
So Vekoma, V-E-K-O-M-A, not Ted Gatzis's horse specifically, but his family.
The Gatzis family, yeah. His brother Mike and his nephew Matt runs the stable. They've had some success over the many years. They had a horse named Gander that was a stakes winner. But this horse is by far the best horse they've ever had. That race in the Bluegrass was really impressive, very impressively run.
So you're a fan of the Kentucky Derby?
I've been following horse racing for longer than you've been alive, probably. So. But he was very impressive and actually impressed the handicappers, early handicappers, because he's one of the favorites for the Kentucky Derby. He's that good a horse.
Okay, and for those not familiar with the Kentucky Derby, how much money are we talking about for the winner?
I believe it's $3 million. Well, it's a $3 million race, so the winner will get a couple million. But the real money in winning the Kentucky Derby, actually in winning any stakes race, is what they call a stud fee. So the horse goes, that's why horses retire so young nowadays after they win the big races.
To make more Kentucky Derby horses, yes.
For example, not that Vekoma is at this level, although you never know, but there was one of the great horses was American Pharoah. Mm-hmm. I think people have heard that name. His stud fee is now $200,000. That means each time he has a liaison, it's $200,000, which is, that's a lot of money when you think about how many times horses go out to stud.
Well, Vekoma, Saturday, May 4th, that's the day everybody will be waiting for to see how Vekoma does. Of course, the Gatzis family very interested in that. Got to wrap up now, but I want to thank our guests for being here. Of course, Hunter Woodall, AP political reporter, first time here on the program. Hunter, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Thank you both for being on the show the whole time.
It's great to be here.
Glad to be on.
Yeah, it's great to have you too. And remember, listeners, the conversation about these stories continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today was Andrew Perella. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Dan Tui was working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.